is Mark Stein. If you enjoy our Sunday Song of the Week, check out Serenade's new Saturday show. An hour of songs around the world, from the continent, from the Commonwealth. And we'll dig deep into six decades of Sinatra. Mark Stein on the Town, Saturdays at 5, starting the 4th of May on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. April 24th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, where the Royal Newfoundland Regiment, the only one of His Majesty's North American regiments to fight at Gallipoli in 1915, is preparing for tomorrow's march from Government House to the National War Memorial in commemoration of what is elsewhere known as Anzac Day. Beyond the Americas, it is 8 p.m. British summertime, 9 p.m. in Paris, 10 p.m. on the aforementioned Gallipoli Peninsula, where Aussie and Kiwi soldiers gathering on the eve of Anzac Day. The New Zealand uniforms and band instruments got lost en route. I believe they're with baggage handlers in Dubai. But their Australian cousins pitched in. They lent the Kiwi bugler a bugle for the last post. So all ceremonies will proceed as scheduled. It is 11 p.m. in the also aforementioned lost luggage office in Dubai, midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone, 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, I'm sorry about that, 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, where the dawn services for Anzac Day are about to get underway, 7 a.m. in Auckland, and even deeper into Anzac Day observances in Niue, the Cook Islands, Tonga, Samoa, Tokelau, Kiribati. They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. Lawrence Binyon's famous lines will be heard at a lot of Anzac Day ceremonies in the next few hours. Not much of a voice today, and I'm a little bit sniffly, and someone has moved the lozenges from the studio, which is most annoying. There'll be blood on the floor and mass sackings when I get to the bottom of that. But I'm going to endeavour to stagger through to the end of the hour. Windy and rainy where I am, so I hope it's more agreeable where you are. At the District of Columbia Superior Court, Mann versus Stein is now cruising effortlessly into its 13th year. Meanwhile, we are, what is it, about a month and a half from my court date in the King's Bench Division of the English High Court against the UK media censor Ofcom. I thank all of you who, in order to show support for one or other or both of these free speech cases on either side of the Atlantic, have bought a chum a Stein Online gift certificate or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. They've been very indispensable to keeping me in the game all this time. The process is the punishment, as I first said nearly 20 years ago, and the process is exceedingly expensive. On which subject, Chris Davis writes, Mark, after yesterday, we really need to reinstate Britpop Brit Wanker Corporate of the Week. Alternatively, we could just give it to Sir Mark Rowley every week. Well, you know, we started Brit Wanker Corporate over four years ago, in the first days of the COVID lockdowns, when they were arresting people if they were caught out in the park and they were sitting on a bench relaxing rather than taking their half-hour exercise, or if they were observed coming out of a Costa, that's the British coffee chain, that is not the one closest to their house, but the one a mile and a quarter away. And I think we did for a while do Brit Wanker Copper of the Day. And almost every day, I mean, we tried just for the sake of variety to include English provincial forces and Northern Irish Constabulary and Police Scotland and whatnot. But we could actually have done it with the Metropolitan Police every single day of the week, because that's how much wankerization has gone on in the first police force of the modern world, Sir Robert Peel's Metropolitan Police, which is coming up to its bicentennial. And if they had any respect for Sir Robert Peel, they would actually disband the Metropolitan Police, because Mark Rowley, who, as Chris just mentioned, is the current commissioner, is a complete disgrace, as are innumerable of his officers. Chris says, not only was Tommy Robinson's case tossed after his dispersal order was not properly served, the bail conditions were unlawful and all the body cam footage mysteriously disappeared, but the sight of the St. George's flag in London was the red rag to the Met's bull. No such problem with the Palestinian protests, naturally, where the red rag is replaced with red carpet. Just the £60,000 in legal fees for Tommy to achieve justice, better than $1 million in punitive damages, I suppose. You know, I would give anything to have a case that just cost me 60,000 quid. When I look at the millions and millions and millions that have gone down the toilet in the District of Columbia, it's evil, the cost of American litigation. 18 months in post, continues Chris, and Mark Rowley has presided over the impossible. He is a worse Met police commissioner than Cressida Dick. That is some achievement. Yes, I remember on the day that Cressida Dick was forced to resign, Paul Gambaccini, who was one of many people who was stitched up by Cressida Dick, we called him. And he said, I'm not really in the mood to be doing telly, he goes, but I'll make an exception to come on and piss all over Cressida Dick, which he did. That is some achievement. Your demographic predictions are coming true. Two-tier policing is now an absolute reality in the UK's capital city. And as we head below one in three of London's population being white British, how long until Islam controls all of the top jobs that impact the freedoms of expression and association of the populace? Well, we mentioned Tommy Robinson's case. I mean, the judge had a rather, I think I said, the judge had dismissed the case on the grounds that his arrest, on the quaint grounds that his arrest was not lawful. That's how it is. And do you know, I loathe that. I can't be bothered with a lot of commentary on social media and everything, because the grisly suck-ups of the lefty progressives these days, the guys who, you know, in the 60s would have been going on about the man and sticking it to the man, now they're basically huge suck-ups to the man. So the fact that, Tommy Robinson, the police said he wasn't allowed to set foot in the capital city. And yet he deliberately went and provoked them by setting foot in the capital city. And well, all that has just been tossed out by the judge on the quaint grounds, as I put it, that it's not lawful. And they knew it wasn't. They're not, well, you know, a lot of those Met policemen are idiots, but the ones that make the decisions about these things are not idiots. And the shenanigans that went on, you know, this business about the so-called dyslexic police officer writing 10 a.m. on whatever it was, the relevant bit of paperwork, when in fact the so-called dispersal order didn't come into effect until 2 p.m. The bail conditions, including that, oh, you can't set foot in your capital city, are also unlawful. Now, the judiciary in England are not what they were. I was having a chat about this with my own solicitor just, I think it was yesterday. And Tommy was very fortunate to come up against a judge who actually attached priority to the law and to the constabulary's requirement to work within the law. But he won a huge absolute. Don't be under any illusions about this. This was a huge victory for Tommy Robinson, and he should get that £60,000 back. You know, the Metropolitan Police should have to pay for what they did to him. What's happened is that Tommy Robinson is like the equivalent of Trump in America. Basically, a huge portion of the British state has determined to get Tommy Robinson. It doesn't care what they get him on. They just have to get him and then figure it out afterwards. So they're, whatever that British expression is, playing the man, not the ball. It's, you know, show me Tommy Robinson and I'll show you the crime. Okay? Well, they got Tommy Robinson in court, and the wankers of the Metropolitan Police were unable to show the crime. And there's something, you know, the thing about this is everyone think all these lefties on Twitter, Facebook, they think it's cute that. They think it's cute that you decide someone is guilty of wrongthink. He's one of the bad whites, as my former National Review colleague would think, John Derbyshire would say. That's to say that he's not on board with all the pieties of the progressive whites. And so he has to be gotten. He has to be. And again, it's for the same reason, because he was effective on certain matters. And you don't have to like Tommy Robinson, although I don't find, as I think I said last week or a couple of days ago or somewhere or other, I don't find this tone policing, you know, oh, yes, yes, we obviously there's, you know, we're anti-immigration and we have concerns about grooming gangs, but we're not with Tommy Robinson. No. We're the respectable side of the anti-grooming gang movement. Well, everything's getting terribly ineffectual because of these concerns about tone policing. I said 20 years ago that if the respectable parties decline to take up certain subjects of concern to the masses, then the masses will turn to unrespectable ones. And at that point, the question becomes, are you serious about these issues? Do you take grooming gangs seriously? You know, do you take these subjects seriously, or are you just concerned to stay respectable? Tommy Robinson, the police and the British state have behaved utterly disgracefully to Tommy Robinson. As I said, it's but he committed mortgage fraud. Yeah, do you know what mortgage fraud is? Do you know anything about that? Do you know other people who've committed mortgage fraud? Do they get put in violent prisons in a cell next door to Muslim gang members who can beat the crap out of it? No, they targeted Tommy Robinson. And in this case, the wanker coppers of the Metropolitan Police couldn't even be bothered, having cooked up a phony baloney arrest, to actually get all their paperwork in line. So, you know, I'm not. It was a tremendous victory for him. It was a 100% victory for him, and it was and he deserves to have a great victory to celebrate. And for that 60,000 quid to be reimbursed to him. I thought I saw somewhere. Let me see if I can pull this up. Because I saw another question about this that I'd like to get to. Just bear with me a moment, if you will. Talk amongst yes. This came from, who did it come from? I thought I saw a question. Oh, yeah, I think it was from Norman Fenton. Don't know where that question's got to. I will come up with it in just a moment. Just I should give a time check, maybe do a weather report, maybe talk about traffic backed up on the Hanger Lane gyratory system or something, but I will find it in AIM. Oh, here it is. Here's Norman's question. This relates to Gideon Falter, the guy who was threatened with arrest for perambulating while openly Jewish. And Norman Fenton, as you know, Norman was one of these guys who was absolutely great on all the COVID stuff and the vaccines and all the rest of it. Norman says, while Gideon Falter, the guy who was threatened with arrest for being openly Jewish while reporting on one of the pro-Hamas rallies, did well in highlighting the two-tier policing in London, don't you think it's also pretty hypocritical? He was a key figure, along with the idiots of the Board of Deputies, who actually also despise him for being too openly Jewish in public. He was a key figure whose opposition to Tommy Robinson being present to report on a march against anti-Semitism led to Tommy's unlawful arrest. Yeah, I said this in yesterday's column, mainly because this name Gideon Falter rang a faint bell with me, and I remembered this thing in, I think it was in The Guardian or The Jewish Chronicle, where he'd said no one wants to march with Tommy Robinson. And in fact, the pretext that the Metropolitan Police used for the arrest of Tommy Robinson was that Gideon Falter, the head of whatever it's called, the campaign against anti-Semitism, had made it clear that he didn't want Tommy Robinson at the march. Well, you don't get to pick. In free countries, you don't get to pick who is allowed to show their support for you. And yet the Met used it as the pretext for arresting Tommy Robinson. And Gideon Falter did this because he wanted respectable. He wanted respectable people to protest anti-Semitism, not the snarling knuckle-draggers from the unfashionable towns of England. He wanted just the respectable people, maybe some, actresses and members of the artistic community and some novelists and persons like that. So he was tone policing. And what happens? He gets arrested on. He gets threatened with arrest on exactly the same grounds. The Metropolitan Police say, well, you know, this is a pro-Palestinian march and you're not welcome at it. These buffoons, and I'll make a larger point about this because I don't want to just talk about Tommy Robinson and Gideon Falter and what goes around comes around, so that Gideon Falter gets threatened with arrest for exactly the same on exactly the same grounds as he wanted Tommy Robinson arrested. But I'll make a bigger point because Norman brings this up. The Board of Deputies are British Jews. There's nothing more useless to Western Jewry than what Ezra Levant in our battles in Canada used to call the official Jews. That's the whatever it's called, the British Board of Deputies of British Jews, the Anti-Defamation League headed by Abe Foxman then in the United States, and in particular the Canadian Jewish Congress headed by Bernie Farber. My late friend Kathy Shadle used to say of Bernie Farber that he must be adopted because he's too stupid to be Jewish. These are the people, Bernie Farber, who made common cause, basically, certainly in the case of Bernie Farber, the Canadian Jewish Congress made common cause with the Canadian Islamic Congress. So when the Canadian Islamic Congress decided to sue me The Canadian Jewish Congress took the side of the Canadian Islamic Congress. I don't even know whether the Canadian Jewish Congress is still going. Maybe they're just a wholly owned subsidiary of the Canadian Islamic Congress now. But I remember when I testified in Parliament in Ottawa, and there were these big shots from the official Jews, the Canadian Jewish Congress and so forth, who were there calling, you know, saying, oh, of course, we quite understand why our Muslim friends want to ban Mark Stein. And Ezra was yelling at them in the corridor between the lower house and the upper house in Parliament, between the House of Commons and the Senate, in the whatever it's called, the central lobby there. He was yelling at the Canadian Jewish Congress guy and the B'nai B'rith guy that they were Jewish book burners, which is correct. And they made common cause with the big shot Islamic groups. And they took the side, and now they're surprised that there are people marching around Western countries saying death to the Jews, gas the Jews outside Sydney Opera House. They're the biggest buffoons in the world. They don't even have the excuse that certain prominent and wealthy German Jews had, whatever it is now, 90 years ago. Oh, just keep your head down for a little and this will all pass over. It's worse than that. You know, those guys can plead that, you know, there'd been anti-Semitism around for centuries and they had no idea that it would suddenly turn genocidal and millions of people would die. These guys don't have that excuse. And they're a large part of the reason why Jews have fewer and fewer friends, particularly among younger people at Columbia University and whatever. Because generally speaking, these so-called official Jews have been on the side of the mass migration that has utterly ruined Western nations. Now, just to go back, and you know, I say that to Norman. I haven't particularly followed the British Board of Deputies, but they would have to be awfully atypical not to have been like the official Jews in America, the official Jews in Canada, the official Jews in Europe. It's a huge problem. And just to go back to Chris's point about two-tier policing, where we're talking about a situation where nothing flat, basically since Tony Blair, the Chris calls the white British population of London, the capital city of London. So we're talking about people who are English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, right? They've fallen to a third. And that means that by the time of the 20, what do you want to bet for the 2031 census? They'll have fallen to a quarter. They're about to become an extinct species. Nobody mentions them on Earth Day, that they're an endangered species in their own capital city. So you have a choice. You have basically a choice between colonial policing. You can do what the Yanks do in some of the, like Ferguson, Missouri, where everyone said, oh, well, wait a minute, this town is whatever percentage it was black, but all the policemen are white. Or you can do, as I said, the colonial model, which you have in British colonies such as Bermuda or Montserrat, where the practice is, you know, you fly in a couple of white senior officers who are from London or from Canada or wherever. You know, you'll find, say, some ex, you know, a Mountie who wants to spend his last few years having a rather more agreeable and less demanding time. But the majority of the constabulary are obviously recruited locally in Montserrat or Bermuda. And because people in Montserrat and Bermuda are largely black, they're black. So if you've got a city that is is where English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh are below 30%, heading down to 20%, your constables are going to be from the other crowd. They're going to, and when that crowd is predominantly migrants from cultures where Jews are, as I said, either dead or fled, you're going to have you're not going to have constables who are going to be interested in protecting Jewish civil rights. This is a consequence of the stupidity of the policies that the official Jews have supported. And that's just basic arithmetic now. I get asked all these very subtle, nuanced questions. You're up against arithmetic. And I've been, every time I'm somewhere like Tangiers, I make a point of going and looking at the Jewish cemetery where some guy is keeping chickens in there and another lady is strings out her washing there. So she's got all her clothes hanging, trailing down on lines over the broken headstones. That's simple arithmetic, you know. And the official Jews have been monumentally stupid. And at the same time, as I said, because there are people who resent the way their cities are alien to them and have become entirely foreign, you have all they're also up against people on both the left-wing people hate the Jews because they're on the side of the Palestinians. But a lot of people on the right hate the official Jews because the official Jews somehow thought that the best way to respond to Europe murdering most of its Jews was to replace them with radical Muslims, you know. So it's hard to find a synagogue, but there's mosques on every corner. So the official Jews, Chris is quite right. And Norman is quite right in what he hints at, in large part brought a lot of this on themselves. Hart says, Mark, what do you think is the reason for the inordinate number of females represented at these pro-Gaza anti-Israel university protests? And not only at the universities, in recent videos of anti-Israel street protests in France, the vast majority of protesters were female. Not that I doubt the demented sincerity of these women, but is this a clever tactic of the protest's organisers, i.e. put loud, vulgar women on the front lines of these protests, with the old chauvinistic idea that the authorities will be more reluctant to disperse, discipline or jail females? It seems effective. Additionally, it seems that females, who now predominate in school and hospital administrations, are the strongest advocates of transgenderism and its abhorrent mutilations. I saw an old Jordan Peterson video where he touched on this subject and attributed it, at least partially, to a dangerous extension of the mothering instinct. What is your take on these matters? I think a lot of it is just the numbers on these things. I don't know what it's like elsewhere, but I think I saw across the river from me in the Green Mountain state of Vermont that the University of Vermont's incoming class is like 60% female or whatever. You couldn't have had a majority female university protest at Columbia a century ago because there were far fewer women. But as you point out, most of the desirable places in our societies are now dominated by women. That is true of education, that's true of healthcare, that's true of the legal profession, and these things go along with that. Men are on the way out because there's not much use for them. In a feminized culture, what do you want men for? And certainly, as we've seen, the women, the woman standing there basically urging the military wing of Hamas to do to the Jewish protesters at Columbia what they did to those Jews at the music festival in Israel. This idea that it always makes me laugh and say, oh, we wouldn't have any of these wars if women ran the world. I don't buy that because I think you have a lot of these visceral, emotional reactions to things. I always think of like the Second World War veterans I knew. And they'd every year, you know, I'm talking about from British Commonwealth countries, but like every year or every other year, they'd fly off for reunions with people they'd, with Germans, they'd fly off to some Belgian town for some reunion commemorating some vicious bloody battle they'd fought there in 1944 or whatever. And whereas now it's so they had a sort of they'd always come back with photographs of them having a pint of beer or something, and the idea was that they'd respect their enemies and look on it as just a good professional job and say what you like, but you have to. And there's something different now, this sort of just visceral emotional hatred of people. And for whatever reason, as Hart points out, there's a lot of women exemplifying that on the streets of Western cities. That just seems to have been the way it's gone. Let's pause a moment from the passing charivari for a bit of music. Sir Andrew Davis, a great conductor, died at the weekend. He was 80. 80, which I found incredible because I knew him when he was the musical director at Glyndebourne, and I used to present the live opera broadcast from there on Channel 4. He was a great conductor of opera and opera singers. That's a long time ago now, but he was full of boyish, impish energy and enthusiasm, and I loved to watch him conduct because you could see his love for the work. If you were sort of the orchestra side of things, if I was, like standing in the wings or whatever, so it wasn't a distracting thing for the audience or whatever, but you could tell he loved the music. And he had long and rewarding musical relationships in almost every corner of the globe, with the Chicago Symphony, with the Melbourne Symphony, with the Toronto Symphony. I was strolling through Cabbage Town in Toronto a couple of years back, and I see they've now got a Sir Andrew Davis Lane. It was just south of Wellesley, I think it was, and he certainly deserves that honour. Anyway, on this day after St. George's Day, which is always observed in a somewhat muted fashion, with no official recognition because the authorities in England do not wish to acknowledge an English National Day. So on this day after St. George's Day, I thought we'd hear Andrew Davis conducting some English music. And it doesn't get any more English than Sir Edward Elgar. He wrote this in 1888 for Miss Caroline Alice Roberts, the future Lady Elgar. And because Miss Roberts was fluent in German, he gave it a German title, Liebesgruß, Love's Greeting. It was a huge flop. And then his publisher gave it a bit of thought and decided to rename it and translate the title into French. And under the new French name, it became a hit all over Europe. Make of that what you will. Sir Andrew Davis conducts Sir Edward Elgar. Salut d'amour. Thank you. Salut d'amour by Sir Edward Elgar. Such a lovely tune. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Andrew Davis, who died at the weekend. Having had some English music in this interval between St. George's Day and Anzac Day, let's have some Australian music. As I said, Andrew Davis was, among other things, principal conductor of the Melbourne Symphony, and Percy Grainger is one of Melbourne's greatest musical sons. This is Mr. Grainger's setting of a famous Kipling poem about the execution of a soldier, which everyone else in the regiment is compelled to watch, because such an event is felt to bring shame upon the entire regiment. In the chaos of Gallipoli, where Aussie and Kiwi soldiers are gathered right now, you could be sentenced to death for, among other things, falling asleep on sentry duty. I think over 100 death sentences were handed out by the ad hoc tribunals at Gallipoli. And then the British commander, Sir Ian Hamilton, commuted almost all of them, all but three, I think. He commuted almost all of them to 5 years imprisonment. That didn't necessarily work out for the recipient. A New Zealand soldier was sentenced to death, had his sentence commuted by General Hamilton, and then was killed in action 2 days later. Andrew Davis conducts Percy Grainger's setting of Rudyard Kipling. Danny Deevil.
Turn you out,
the colours sergeant say.
What makes you look so white, so white?
Set fires on parade.
I'm dreading what I've got to watch,
the colours sergeant say. For the angry Danny Deevil, you can hear the death march play. The regiment's in Mollo's Square, they're hanging him today. Taken off his buttons off and cut his stripes away, and they're hanging Danny Deevil in the morning.
What makes a rear end breathe so hard?
Set fires on parade.
It's bitter cold,
the colour sergeant said.
Set front rank manslaughter,
set fires on parade.
A touch of sun,
the colours sergeant said. They are hanging Danny Deevil, they are marching on him around. They're bold to Danny Deevil, while he's coughing on the ground. Swinging of a minute for a sneaking shooting.
I'd ain't caught a mind.
St. Father's on parade.
He's sleeping out and far tonight.
The sergeant saved.
I've drunk his beer a score of times.
St. Father's on parade.
He's drinking beer alone.
The sergeant saved.
Danny Deva in the morning. Words by Rudyard Kipling, music by Percy Grainger, the baritone Jose Cabo with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by my old Glyndebourne compadre, Sir Andrew Davis, who died just a few days ago. Post St. George's Day, pre Anzac Day, Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 18 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That is 18 to 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us get back to your questions. Bill Holcomb says, I'm the proud possessor of a founding Stein Club membership, a Prisoner of Windsor signed copy, and a climate derangement hockey stick. Thank you for that, Bill. Thank you for that. You seem determined to collect the set, and we are very grateful to you for doing that. Keep fighting the good fight, says Bill. Do you think the Columbia and Yale riots could have been prevented by distributing more coexist bumper stickers a few years back? Do you know, in some strange way, I haven't thought about the coexist bumper sticker. I don't know whether it's me, but I don't seem to see as many of them as I did in the days after 9/11, when if you'd cross over the Connecticut River to Vermont, all the people with Subarus all seemed, I think it came, the coexist bumper sticker was standard when you got a new Subaru. Possibly it's like the passenger side airbag. You could disable it if you took it into the shop or whatever. They knew how to disable. I think it's the same thing. If you took it into the shop, they knew how to disable the coexist bumper sticker. But it seemed to come standard with Subarus in the days after 9/11. But if you don't remember the car, and I don't know why there seem to be fewer about, but my fear is that basically it's just because one side won. But the coexist bumper sticker, if you don't remember it, it had like the Christian cross, I think, for the T. And then was it the Buddhist thing for the S? And for the X, it was the Star of David for the Jews. And I think the E was the male and female transgender bathroom thing or whatever that's meant to be. And the O was the peace sign. But the C was the crescent of Islam. And the reality, the stupid thing about the coexist bumper sticker was if it wasn't for the C for the Islamic crescent, you wouldn't need a bumper sticker at all. because they're the ones who have got the problems with the Jews in the Holy Land. They've got the problems with the Buddhists in southern Thailand. They've got the problems with the Christians in Nigeria. You wouldn't need a coexist bumper sticker if it wasn't for the Islamic crescent providing the sea. And this is just stupid now. Do you know, the sentimental bollocks, it's incredible when you think about it, but the suffocating sentimental bollocks that at heart, unless you're less sentient than an earthworm, you know is bollocks. I always put it this way, because I went off, did a little bit of Islamic touring, I think about 6 months after 9/11. And, you know, I like the idea of Prada Islam, as they called it. You know, these the hot Islamo-totty, the ones if you fly, I've talked about this, if you fly Royal Jordanian, the minute they clear... Basically, the minute they clear Arab airspace, all the covered women go into the ladies' toilets in first class and emerge from the bathroom, all, you know, with their beautiful glossy black hair and just this shimmering little chiffon scarf on the top and everything. Spectacular sight. And I take people as I find them. And that's true in Northern Ireland. That's true in Bosnia. That's true in Fiji. But I'm not going to be dishonest about it. You can be enjoying a drink with some smoking hot bit of Islamo-totty, and she's very pleasant and highly sensual and all the rest of it, but she hates Jews. It's just a fact. You know, she doesn't necessarily hate Jews enough to go around stabbing them or blowing them up, but the people who do that, she's on board with. And the coexist bumper sticker, if the beginning and end, you know, I'm a great believer in cultural confidence because it does, it can make a difference. It made a difference when the British governed India and they had a problem with various excitable Mohammedans occasionally deciding to take out the local officials and kill them. There is a kind of cultural confidence that can cow a population. I'm not doing my usual imperialist shtick here. The Soviet Union held the lid on a lot of it in the Central Asian stands. That guy, what was he called? Turkmenbashi in Turkmenistan. When he put some crazy book of his own on an equal par with the Quran and ordered it to be placed in every mosque. He also held the lid on the Islamo-crazy. The Indonesian dictatorship did. So a certain kind of, these aren't particularly, certainly for Americans, Indonesia and the Soviet Union and even the British Empire are not attractive models to a lot of Americans, but in their various ways they worked as exercises in cultural confidence. The idea that having a bumper sticker, you know, with this, oh, this is so clever. Oh, look at it. It's got a C for the Islamic crescent, and then it's got the symbol of peace. Oh, and then we're going to put the Star of David for the X. If that's rubbish. You'll die. Your society will die. You're like those peaceniks at the Israeli music festival who all wound up gang raped. Did you see those pictures of the girls with all the blood between their legs? They'd been doing all the peace bollocks, and it is bollocks. And it's not just that it's totally ineffectual, but it's a sign that you will go willingly to the slaughter. So, you know, the idea that there are millions of wankers around the Western world who take the coexist bumper sticker seriously. You know, bottom line, if it weren't for the Islamic Sea, you wouldn't need a bloody bumper sticker. William Strug says, "Dear Mark, I'm an American Jew, and your Tuesday Strolling While Jewish column on the state of things was right and terrifying. Even before the war, I advised my daughter not to wear a chai or Star of David around New York City." That's absolutely incredible. You know, for almost 20 years now, we've had things like German police chiefs telling people in Germany not to go around with telling Jews not to go around with identifying marks of their faith. Then in Toulouse, you actually have rabbis in France telling Jews not to go around with identifying marks of their faith. But it is incredible that that is now happening in New York City, the most Jewish city on the planet. And the point of my Tuesday column was that, in a sense, America to today's Jews is what Germany was to the Jews of a century ago. It's where you wanted to be. It's where you could prosper. It's where you dominated all the leading professions. William continues, I advise my daughter not to wear a Star of David around New York. For my part, I wear an Israel baseball cap everywhere I go and pro-Israel T-shirts to the gym. I've received nothing but compliments, but our oldest daughter is looking at colleges and the pogroms, let's call them what they are, on college campuses, has forced my wife and I to reconsider where we send her. Even local Rutgers in northern New Jersey is a hotbed of Judenhass, to use a term the college anti-Jewish protesters will understand. When New York and New Jersey are unsafe for Jews, the golden age for Jews in America is over. Yeah, it's interesting to me, this. A friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, one of my oldest friends, he was strolling down Piccadilly in London. This isn't from our current Agatha Christie serialization, although there's a fair bit of strolling down Piccadilly in that. But he was strolling down Piccadilly just a couple of months back, and he went into a coffee shop, a Starbucks or whatever it was. And he's standing there at the counter waiting for his decaf macchiato when all these pro-Palestinian demonstrators come in. And so they're all wearing the kefir, they're all wearing the Palestinian flag, it's on everything. And they notice that he's the only guy in there who isn't wearing a Palestinian scarf. And so they go, "Where's your scarf?" And he's no spring chicken. And he's been in poor health, so he moves around a little bit wobbly these days. But he nevertheless said, I'm not sure I would have given such a provocative answer. And he goes, "Well, I'm not wearing a scarf, but if I did, it would be in different colours," right? So he's doing an in-your-face thing to a guy who's like a third of his age or whatever. And they're all around him. And he sticks to his guns because, as usual, you know, the guy behind the counter is taking 12 minutes to whoosh and froth the decaf macchiato. But this, and you think to yourself, well, okay, that's London, not going to be any Jews in London, there's not going to be any Jews in Paris, there's not going to be any Jews in your town here. But when people are doing that in New York, I saw John Podhoretz has been, ever since that thing, since they're advising Jews to leave the campuses and go somewhere, he's like horrified. He's like, "When did I become Anne Frank? Why do I have to spend all the time in the attic now?" Well, because in part, this is the world that American Jews made. We've had some comments from Stein Online readers who say, "Well, what's the big deal here? This is lefty Jews versus lefty Jew haters. Who cares?" The reason to care is because, as I said in After America, education is the biggest structural defect in America. Nobody learns anything in American education. I'm not just talking about Ivy League colleges. I'm talking about kindergarten in your local grade school. Nobody learns anything. It's completely undemanding. And in the vacuum incubate, kids are like sponges at a certain age when they're at grade school, and they want to soak stuff up. And if, as in the crappy American system, you don't provide anything for them to soak up, then they'll soak up other things. And if you're lucky, it might just be, they get a bit crazy for the climate change. But if you're not, it'll be darker pathologies. And either way, it destroys, if you have a lousy, I always point out that in 1940, the majority of Americans had an eighth grade education. For our non-American listeners, that's 13 years of age. But those eight grades were effective. They weren't having their time wasted as they are now when they don't stay at school through grade 13. They stay at school to grade 23 and in some cases 33. And they know nothing when they come out of it. They don't know anything. It's not that when I was probably the last generation. Sebastian Foakes has a great line on this in one of his novels about being the last generation where it was accepted that the point of education was to teach you things, teach you facts, teach you theories, teach you so that you had enough facts in your head to be grounded in whatever it was you were talking about. People don't do that now. I'm always amazed by I was slightly amazed yesterday at the number of people who were stunned by the comparison I made with Germany a century ago, because I would have thought it was obvious. We talk about it here in Stein and Line, and in that A Journey Through the Book of Vienna by Sir Cheverel Sitwell, where he's talking about the Jews. If you're born in these like primitive Jewish villages where life is very hard out in Ukraine, and you think, oh, it's great, though, because I'm on the furthest fringes of the Habsburg Empire, so one day I can get out of here and take a train to Vienna. The object was to get out of points east and make it to a German-speaking country because they treated Jews the best, and you could become a big-shot lawyer, or you could become a big-shot composer, or you could become a big-shot scientist. And that's what somewhere like New York has been for Jews since the Second World War. But nobody knows. Our education system in America is so crap. And that's why, by the way, I've said this before. We say, oh, you know, the legacy guys at these Ivy League colleges are getting a bit concerned about this and wondering whether they should give. If you send your kids to these places and you give money to these places, you're part of the problem. They think you're a rube and a patsy. You're giving money and they're going to name some building after you. What they're going to do is they're going to raise a bunch of people who think America is garbage and who are basically, oh, dead to America. Oh, yes, I love to go outside and chant dead to America. It's so good. And the great thing about chanting dead to America, it used to be quite lonely when you'd go into the streets of an American city and chant dead to America. But now it's great because all the Americans join in with the chanting of death to America. That's the world, you idiots. I had a great time at my college in the 1950s, and I made a ton of money in the years since, and I'm going to give all the money to the college so they can raise a generation of death to America chanters. Brilliant. Amar Marzouk says, greetings and salutations from an Australian follower who is now in France. So hearing live. Wonder what your take is on the Australian e-commissar demanding that the images of an Islamist stabbing a bishop should not be seen by the people of Ecuador, Zambia, Morocco, Nepal, etc., etc. What are the implications if this control freakness takes hold, says Amar. You're absolutely right. This is, which I believe we've posted at Stein Online because it turned up in a tweet. He was an Orthodox bishop and he was in the middle of his service and some crazy guy comes up and starts stabbing him. It's there. It's captured live on the tweet. And it's not easy to look at, but it's what the modern world is. It's a place where all civilization is a very thin veneer on barbarism, And what our political classes have done in creating these stupid multicultural societies is made that veneer even thinner. And people are not well informed about this, or people who are nevertheless think the odds are pretty good. So, yeah, you can be, as we've talked about with Ava and others on the show, you can be strolling in a French park with your kids and suddenly some guy comes out of nowhere and starts stabbing all the kids. Or you can be at church in Sydney and suddenly some guy comes in and starts stabbing your vicar. Your bishop, in this case. The bishop himself wants the video left up on social media. He's been stabbed, and he'd like people to see him getting stabbed, just to understand what's going on. And the Australian authorities are now, in fact, because I believe Elon Musk has kept it up on Twitter, There was some bonehead Australian senator demanding that Elon Musk be jailed for keeping this up on Twitter. Good luck with that, you Australian Senate loser. That's all. You know, the only advantage of the modern world, the internet has gotten worse in the last 20 years. But the only advantage is there's a moment, you know, when something happens, and for an hour or two, oh, look at this, something's on Twitter, something's going on in a French park, in a Sydney church, whatever it is. And you've got a couple of hours to see the reality. And then the forces that be. It used to be that 20 years ago, it was thought that the internet would be a means of liberation, that you would have access to even more information. And the people who govern our world, and I'm not just talking about the Chinese Politburo, but Western governments think it is now a brilliant system of control. That's what the COVID years taught them. James Hanley says, "Dear Mr. Snine, I'm a founding member, and although I've listened to most of the Clubland Q&As over the years, I've never submitted a question. But the insane times in which we seem to be living have compelled me to ask a question that I hope you will take seriously. Although, so this is like your first question after whatever it is now, coming up to 7 years of listening. Although I voted twice for Donald Trump, I do not think he should be the Republican choice for president again. I won't detail the reasons, but just note a couple. One, what quality of people would even be willing to work with and for Trump? We need a great many well-qualified cabinet and sub-cabinet members." Well, I'm not going to argue that point with you, James. I don't know about well qualified because, you know, basically since Ronald Reagan went to Eureka College, in the last 40 years, America has had government by the Ivy League and the country has gone down the toilet. So I'm not sure qualifications is the thing we should be looking for. You need people who can do the job. But your point, your general point is taken that if you accept a job from Trump, you need to be prepared to end your life as a convicted criminal who's broke, because they're going to do their best to put you in jail. And we've seen that with the people who have been ruined through their association with Trump and what the Democrats have done to them, whether you're talking about Rudy Giuliani, Peter Navarro, whoever, or Jenna Ellis, whoever. And two, says Mr. Hanley, "these are the times that require a candidate who is self-controlled, relatively honest and intelligent. We dare not elect at this time someone who shoots from the hip as often as President Trump and makes policy decisions with little or no thoughtful consideration. Three, despite your suggestions on occasion that Trump deserves revenge for the way he was treated, may I respectively suggest that the times are too perilous to have a president who is perpetually viewing people and circumstances through his lens of revenge seeking. With that background painted, this is my question. What can the Republicans do through convention maneuvers or some other tactic to present a good, not perfect candidate to the American public? Sincerely, Jim Hanley." Well, that's an interesting question. What can the Republicans do through convention maneuvers? What we have is large numbers of people. There's been no interest in any other candidate, and that includes people who in any other season would have been respectable and effective candidates, whatever you think of them or whatever you think of their policies. But, you know, Nikki Haley, whom I personally don't care for, or Governor DeSantis from Florida. Tim Scott is a senator. You know, these are credible persons. And basically, the overwhelming majority of the Republican electorate have had zero interest in them. So if you then say, oh, yeah, OK, vote, and then we're going to figure out a way to take it away from you at the convention, you're basically assuring Biden of his second term. So that is not something that should be done lightly. Secondly, you would need to what these Republican voters get is something I learned during my battles with the Canadian Human Rights Commissions, and which I decided early on. My friend Julian Porter, KC, a very eminent barrister, and Ken White, the publisher at Maclean's, we had a sort of chit-chat early on, and we all agreed I was not going to defend the substance of my column or my, you know, the facts in my essay or anything like that. We were going, and I wasn't particularly interested in attacking the Canadian Islamic Congress guys, except as collateral. We were going to make the system the issue. And we did that so effectively that they basically took themselves out of the thought police business, and eventually the law giving them the authority to do so was repealed. Now, that's what Republican voters have gotten here, that when Trump and anyone associated with Trump, include his lawyers, are threatened with being struck off or whatever you call it, they're forced, strong-armed into pleading guilty to non-crimes, they're slapped with fines that bankrupt them and are thrown in jail for contempt. The system is the issue. Now, I would be prepared to entertain Jim's argument if there had been an outraged pushback from alternative Republican leaders. You know, if you pointed to me and said, oh, well, this guy in the House of Representatives and that governor over there and a couple of senators here are all saying that this is completely, what's going on is completely disgraceful. But they're not. They're all very sotto voce about it. And unlike the Republican voter base, they're not outraged at this. So the idea that you could find some guy who hasn't said a peep about all this. So then I've mentioned this before. I haven't gone into detail, but Trump screwed me over in a small way. I've sort of hinted at a bit of this, and I suppose one day I'll say it all. But, you know, I was asked if I would be interested in some certain position. And I wasn't really, but I sort of took the view that, you know, you can't say no to it. So I sort of strung along with it. And then Jared or whoever said, no, he might be a bit strong. Trump dropped. So I got no reason to support Trump personally, except, and I think Trump has hung out with all kinds of people who he shouldn't be hanging out with. But I do agree that what is at issue here is that once you weaponize the justice system against your political opponents, you can't then pretend we are in a time of ordinary politics. And yes, it would be the kind of, you know, so let's say Nikki Haley had won a couple of primaries and had remained competitive, and there was a way to sort of get her over the line come the convention. I think they would do. The Democrats have got a bloodlust up, and they feel the way about not just about Trump, but about people associated with Trump. And so the only kind of people out there would be people who would be thinking, well, if I just don't sort of, you know, I don't want to be like Rudy Giuliani and sort of go all in with Trump. So you basically would be having to find someone willing to repudiate the entirety of Trump's first term in the hopes of persuading Democrat prosecutors in this or that city not to drag him into court. The fact of the matter is, America is in a far worse situation than the house-trained members of the Republican Party think it is. Nothing it does works. It's broke. It can't win any. It's accountable for 40% of the planet's military spending, and it can't defeat goat herds. It doesn't matter what front. It's outsourced its manufacturing to China and enabled the Chinese to come up with the only economically viable form of communism, so that China has now gobbled up all the resources in Africa and, in fact, you know, in Jamaica and Canada and actually far closer to home for America. It's crapped out on every front. And as I said, the Constitution isn't going to save you from this, because there's no point having the greatest constitution in the world if you've got the worst election system in the world. And the fact is that right now, America is sliding off the cliff and dragging the rest of Western civilization with it, which will be the only thing anybody remembers. And so the Constitution isn't going to cover that. And so for me, as an act of political hygiene, it is necessary to repudiate what happened in 2020. Now, it may not be possible to do that. Jim adds as a postscript, I know that you think the Republican Party is worthless and want a third party started, but I respectfully suggest that the time is too perilous and too short to do anything but elect a decent Republican candidate who can at least defeat the puppet that now dances to the tune of some unknown puppet masters. But you don't name a potential candidate. That's the point. Who is that going to be? If we were in the classic era of the smoke-filled rooms, you know, so they all get together for the convention, wherever it is, and the TV screens go blank for a bit, and then they come out and they hold the count, and some crackerjack senator or governor emerges as the candidate. But who is that guy? Because if it's just a go-along-to-get-along guy, I don't know. I don't know. And the time is always too perilous and too, because you have elections every 2 years. So it's very difficult to start. And there's never a good time to start a new party, not in America. Avida says, thank goodness the MAGA knuckleheads of Congress were thwarted in their bid to stop aid to the Ukraine. The Ukraine, you can't keep saying the Ukraine. It lost its definite article. They don't like it when you use the definite article. The Russians bombed the definite article out of Ukraine a couple of years ago. The Ukraine needs to be in some position of strength when the issue finally reaches the negotiating table, says Avida. Concerning the imminent American presidential election, it is shaping up to be one of the most dismal farces of recent times. Two very flawed front runners and not a credible third party candidate in sight. Could the congressional elections of 2024 bring at least some sane relief? I have no handle as to the quality of the candidates on offer. It's an important point to ponder. The American government is more than just the presidency. That is true. But Congress is weak and deferential to the administrative state, which is a big part of the problem. And when you talk about the MAGA knuckleheads thwarted in their bid to stop aid to Ukraine, you know, Ukraine's problem at the moment is that its menfolk are dying. And it's a demographically weak state. This is the first war between two countries in the demographic death spiral. Russia, if you look back at their heroic resistance to the sieges of the Second World War, they can't do that now because they don't have enough. They're a demographically weakened society, but they're up against one, Ukraine, which is even weaker. And what's happened is that a huge proportion of the Ukrainian population has fled west and has no plans to return. And I think even if the war were to end today, simply on the demographic grounds, it would be impossible for the Ukrainian economy to recover. They just don't have enough workers. They don't have enough men. They don't have enough men for the war, and they don't have enough men for what comes after the war. And this is something that American lavishness has done to them, throwing all the money at Ukraine and then letting it all be, because there's no accounting for what's happened to the money. These are incredible sums of money, and Ukraine is the most corrupt country in Europe. And it has sluiced off a lot of it, and it has gone we know not where. So it's like all the wars. It's been great for the military-industrial complex, but it has been a disaster. When you say Ukraine needs to be in some position of strength when the issue finally reaches the negotiating table, this is an obstruction to getting to the negotiating table. The reality is that Ukraine's pre-invasion borders are not going to be restored. America can't win anything. I'm so bored by the national security right, who don't seem to have noticed that ever since, VJ Day, whatever it is now, coming up to 80 years ago, you haven't won anything. The American way of war is crap and doesn't work. It makes money for corrupt generals who, you know, do like 18 months on the Joint Chiefs and then go off to be a lobbyist. That's fine. If you think that's the purpose of a military, then that's fine. But if you think the purpose of a military is to defend a nation's interests and prosecute wars effectively, or even to do it at one remove, as like this. What was interesting is that there was like a 20-minute tea break between Afghanistan and Ukraine. So after Afghanistan, they think, oh, well, this is a bit bad. It looks a bit bad because we've just scuttled out of town and left the Taliban with enough hardware to make them the 8th or 9th most powerful army on earth. So we'll do it differently. We're going to get back, have a shower, change our clothes and start a new war. But we'll do it differently this time. We're going to outsource it to proxies. And they couldn't win the proxy war either. This is not good. This is not good. George Pereira says, Mark, the latest military debacle that resident Brandon spits on the ground in disgust is the US military being run out of Niger in defeat, in abject surrender, lions being led by weasels. It appears that the mostly Islamic Niger doesn't appreciate being a critical node in the war against Al-Qaeda, ISIS and so forth. They are throwing the US military out of their country. They cut power to the $110 million base and prevented the delivery of food, water and medicine. They've starved the base out without a shot being fired. Humming along, everybody knows the tune. No phone, no lights, no motor car. Not a single luxury like Robinson Crusoe. It's primitive as can be. The US is leaving the $110 million base to Niger and their new friends, the Russians and Iran. The US military is leaving another country yet again in defeat, but they are no doubt proudly flying their LGBT blah 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 flags as they slink away, but they are secure in their gender identity and using their pronouns correctly. Again, this is the failure of the American way of war. That base shouldn't have cost $110 million or anything like it. And George is correct that this month, basically, there was a coup in Niger, I think about 9 months ago, something like that. And the new guys, one of their things was they want the Yanks out. I don't know whether the complete military withdrawal. And basically, as George says, America didn't want to leave. And the government of Niger was forced to get tough with the Pentagon. Right? And oddly enough, it worked. Again, they basically ran the most powerful military on Earth, responsible for 40% of the planet's military spending. They ran them out by basically turning the lights off. So at their $110 million base, they were sitting in the dark. Now, I don't know whether that includes... They've also got a CIA base there that the CIA uses to drone various people from. I don't know whether the CIA base has been thrown out. But when I say that the base shouldn't have cost $110 million, I mean that. I think I mentioned before, speaking to an Australian Prime Minister just after, 3 days after he'd got back from Afghanistan, and he was complaining about the Crusader Fort mentality, that you fly in there and then you hold up in these bases, $110 million bases, and the bases have got Burger King and Dunkin' Donuts and whatever, so you never have to leave the base. So necessarily you are perceived as an occupying force because you only venture out to round up certain villagers who are getting a little too restless. So it's a complete, the Crusader Fort mentality is why none of the locals want the American. Because it's not like in Germany where if they want to close an American base, everyone, no, please don't, because they're the big tippers in all the local restaurants. It's not like that now. Nobody wants them there. And, you know, again, it comes back to how do you prosecute your national interests? China snaffled up all the resources in Africa. As George says, a lot of these countries have gone straight over to the Russians. Now, Putin hasn't built a $110 million base in Niger, but oddly enough, they've all gone over to his side anyway. These people... There actually ought to be what do you call it here? It's not a royal commission. that's what they do in Australia and whatever. It's not a royal commission. A blue ribbon commission. They actually should have some blue ribbon commission on why America can't win anything. Come on! We're running out of... This is why I don't... We're running out of time to correct course. Running out of time to correct course. Olga from Arizona says, greetings, Mr. Sine. Super excited about the new Serenade show. We all need more musical diversions to take the edge off the world falling apart. Hope you're taking on a new project corresponds with an improvement in health. Cheers, Olga. I wouldn't necessarily... say that. Short of breath today, short of blood, I think. Put the juice in me, Bruce, as they say in Australia. But I'll tell you a bit more. Maybe I'll tell you a bit more about that next week. Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A across the planet. I've been going on a bit. We've been remembering the conductor, Sir Andrew Davis. So let's have a big finale, I think, for once. I knew Andrew a little through the Glyndebourne Opera. And as I said, he was always a great fizzing and life-affirming presence. He also conducted The last night of the proms at the Royal Albert Hall for many years, which isn't easy. It's a balancing act. And every so often I used to get asked to provide the notes for certain promenade concerts, which I didn't mind doing. But the downside of that was that I'd get asked to the BBC chairman's pre-prom drinks party, which I did mind doing. So it was always good to see Andrew Davis had been inveigled along to have a bit of pre-prom banter with. Here is Andrew on the last night in 1990 with a quintessentially English composition for this day after St. George's Day. Ever since its premiere in 1901, the audience has demanded an encore of the piece, and over the years that encore became formalised. So after the first run-through, Andrew would turn to the crowd and say something like, "Oh, I think we can do better than that." So let's see what he says this time around. Sir Andrew Davis conducts Sir Edward Elgar.
Oh, you want another go of that? Yeah.
And Circumstance and an encore. Pomp and Circumstance March number 1 by Sir Edward Elgar, Sir Andrew Davis conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra and a capacity crowd of lusty singers giving us A.C. Benson's unforgettable words at the Royal Albert Hall for the last night of the proms. Andrew died at the weekend, aged 80. Land of hope and glory, mother of the free, how shall we extol thee who are born of thee? Wider still and wider shall thy bounds be set. God, who made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet. You can't say those words in England anymore. It's a hate crime. Don't even think about it. But you can still sing them here at Stein Online. That'll do it for our show. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. Our brand new Tale for Our Time, The Secret Adversary by Agatha Christie, continues tonight and every night. And we have something rather special coming this weekend. Our official Stein versus the Stick trial merchandise is still available, only now it's the official merchandising for the appellate hearing. Plus ça change, plus ça même case. If you don't fancy that, there's always a Stein Online gift certificate or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.